Welcome back. And as you know, Ajahn Brahm had to go away, so I had to take over instead. So I hope we can deal with that. But so see what happens. So this is really what this is about. It's going to be kind of a continuation of what Ajahn Brahm was doing before. And this particular sutta here, it sort of summarizes the Noble Eightfold Path from a slightly different angle from what you're used to. And very often I teach this particular sutta on the retreat precisely because it gives a different angle. For that reason, it's interesting. And it's also interesting because it shows you some of the foundations of the Buddhist practice. What is it that you have to do to sustain the practice in the long run? What are the factors that kind of, you know, support the rest of the path, the very foundations of the path? These are some of the things I want to have a look at to sort of kind of give you a broader view, if you like, of what the Buddhist practice is about. Because one of the things about the Buddhist practice, if you want to have success in meditation practice, if you want to eventually have some samadhi, if you want to gain some insights on this path, if you want to, you know, the calm and the vipassana and the samatha to become deeper over time, you really have to integrate this path into your life. So the question is, how do you do that? How do you integrate this in a skillful way so it becomes part of your, you know, almost like your entire life becomes about Dhamma practice rather than about world, somewhat too much about worldly concerns. And this is what this really points to at the end, and this is what I want to get to. And this particular sutta, it starts off with the idea of, it says here, knowledge and freedom. You can see on the right-hand side, this Pali words are vijja and vimutti. These are kind of very standard Pali words you find in the suttas everywhere. So this is the highest purpose of the Buddhist practice. This is what you want to aim at, ultimately. And then it takes you stage by stage, factor by factor, all the way back to the kind of the root cause, the basic thing here that gives rise to everything else. It's kind of exciting. What is the root thing that kind of gives rise to this, ultimately, to this liberation and knowledge? Exciting, isn't it? If you can't find the root, all you have to do is go to the root and everything else happens as a consequence. And this is the purpose of these conditioned sequences, is that to show you how things arise out of something else. Here it is called, what is it called here? The fuel. So if you find the initial fuel, the initial spark that sets everything off, then everything else more or less happens as a consequence of that. So very, very interesting here. So how does this work? So first of all, it asks us, what is the fuel for the liberation and knowledge and freedom? So what is the cause for knowledge and freedom? What is the cause for becoming an arahant, basically? What is the cause for awakening itself? Is what this is saying. You will see that it says the cause for awakening is the seven factors of awakening, the seven awakening factors, the seven bhujangas in Pali. And this in itself is actually very interesting, I think, in a very important part of the teachings. And it's something that you find throughout the path. This is, of course, the idea that the root cause, or the main thing that makes it possible to have the profound wisdom on the Buddhist practice is not vipassana. It is not, well, it is vipassana in a sense, but the thing that makes that vipassana possible, that wisdom possible, is always the samadhi. The seven factors of awakening, all about samadhi practice. They have the seven factors. You know the seven factors? Does anyone know the seven factors? Sati. It's the first one. It starts off with mindfulness. Then you have the dhammavicaya, which is the investigation of phenomena, if you like. Then you have the virya first, that's right. Then piti, then pasadi, and then samadhi, and then upeka. So the samadhi and the upeka, the equanimity towards the very end. And all of that is really the geared towards samadhi. All of these things are the factors of samadhi. Piti is a factor of samadhi. Tranquility, pasadi, is a factor of samadhi. Yes, all of this is about stillness of the mind. Not concentration, but stillness. Has that Ram told you that? You can't call it concentration, has he said that? It has to be stillness, okay. Which is a good, actually an interesting point. So it's all about the samadhi which gives rise to these things. That stillness of the mind is what it's all about. And you see it here. You also see it on the Noble Eightfold Path. Because you know on the Noble Eightfold Path, it ends with samadhi. That's the end of the path. And everything comes out of that. That's why it ends with samasamadhi, because everything else is a consequence of the right, of the jhanas, on the samadhi on the end. It's a very important point, because it's something that is basically found throughout the suttas, and sometimes it's a bit different from how the path sometimes is taught. So what is the cause, what is the fuel for the factors of awakening here? And you will see there that it's the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, the four satipatthanas. And this is another very interesting point, because very often the kind of standard way of thinking about Buddhism is the idea that satipatthanas give rise to awakening experiences. Yeah, if you practice satipatthana in the right way, then awakening happens as a consequence. But here it says satipatthanas are the cause for samadhi. That's interesting, isn't it? It's a different way of looking at the path from what how you often think about the path. And this is how it is consistently throughout the suttas. Samma sati, the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, comes before samma samadhi. And again, these are conditioned sequences. One follows upon the other one. One is the cause for the next one. So right mindfulness, or the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, is the cause for the awakening factors. So what is satipatthana practice? And one of the simplest ways, not the cause for satipatthana, Eileen, because I saw you jumping down, but what is it? And what it is one of the main ways of practicing satipatthana is simply to watch the breath. Yeah, I think Ajahn Brahm mentioned this before, breathing meditation, anapanasati, is all about fulfilling the satipatthanas. So you watch the breath, you attain samadhi, and then awakening happens as a consequence. One of these standard passages in the suttas. So that doesn't mean that everything on the Buddhist path is about samatha and there's no room for vipassana. It just means that the idea, the mindfulness of breathing here, encompasses both vipassana and samatha at the same time. But sometimes it is said that mindfulness of breathing is a samatha practice, but it actually, you can't really distinguish samatha and vipassana in that way, because these are two sides of the same coin. If your mind is peaceful, you will see things clearly by definition. If you see things clearly, you're going to be peaceful. You can't really distinguish these things. One of the problems is that very much in modern meditation circles, they talk about vipassana meditation and samatha meditation. But in the sutta, samatha and vipassana are outcomes of meditation. Meditation is not divided up into samatha and vipassana. There is just meditation practice. And if you do it in the right way, it leads to both samatha and vipassana. And this is a very, I think, another important point to kind of to take into account on this path. So all you have to do is really watch the breath. Of course, watching the breath is not necessarily easy. It doesn't happen automatically. But it's a simple idea. You can kind of understand what it refers to, the idea of watching the breath. But it's difficult to do it fully. It's difficult to do it in the right way so it actually works. It is difficult to do it with insight, with understanding, by contemplating the breath, what your obstacles and hindrances are, all of these kind of things. So it's still hard in a certain way. It's hard to get the right attitude towards it. But the idea of watching the breath is very easy. So it's a very simple idea, simple practice, but hard sometimes to make it work. So now it gets a bit more practical. So what is the fuel for the four kinds of mindfulness meditation? And it says here the three kinds of good conduct. And this is one of those extraordinarily important things on the Buddhist path, the idea that it is your conduct that gives rise to meditation practice. It is such an important point, because very often people will ask questions about the meditation. They will ask, am I watching the breath in the right way? Am I doing the right thing? But watching the breath, you can't really do it so many different ways. The breath is there. You are aware of the breath. It's not like some kind of magic trick. You watch the breath from the left or from the right or from the bottom or whatever. You just watch the breath. It's simple. So if you can't watch the breath and the breath meditation doesn't work, it's not because you're watching it in the wrong way, because it's simple to watch. When it works, it's really simple. If it doesn't work, you can't do it. The reason why it doesn't work is because your conduct isn't purified enough yet. That's the reason. It's very easy. And here you have it. Here you have it straight from the suttas. And this is not just one kind of obscure sutta which says this. I kind of found the one sutta which supports my argument, and all the other suttas say the exact opposite. It's not really like that. This is a standard way that Dhamma is taught throughout the suttas. And it fits with the Noble Eightfold Path. If you think about the Noble Eightfold Path, it is all about sila, yeah, the conduct of body and speech, and then also the livelihood, and then you have the Samma Vayama, or the Samma Padana, the right effort, which is all about the conduct of the mind, the purification of the mind. And these things together are what the right kind of conduct is all about, the three kinds of right conduct. Body, speech, and mind is what it's all about. So if your meditation isn't working, if you find it hard to stay with the breath, if your mindfulness is a bit weak, if you tend to wander off, if there is any kind of problem, this is where you need to look. This is the reason why it doesn't work. There's actually more to it than that, slightly more to it than that, but that is kind of the main issue. So for this reason, it is so important to be able to establish your conduct as well as you possibly can in your life. And of course, this is not just about being on retreat, it's about your conduct throughout your life, every day, when you go back to work, when you're with your family or whatever it is. All of these situations, conduct, everything you do, basically will feed into your meditation practice. This is so important and so fundamental for how this path actually works. So to be able to do this, and this is, of course, is not easy. You all know how hard it is. Yeah, never to get upset about anything, never to feel greedy about things, and never to say the wrong thing. It's difficult. It is difficult because we get so sidetracked, because there's all these issues happening in our life. And it's actually a hard thing to do. So the question is, how can we sustain that sila? How can we sustain the good conduct, especially the good conduct of the mind? And this is going to be one of the most important emphases, the thing I'm going to emphasize the most today is how to be able to, in your ordinary life, to support the sila, so you have a continuous good conduct, way of thinking about things that works out. And then when you come back on retreat next time, wherever that is, then hopefully your mindfulness will be a little bit more powerful. The meditation on the breath will be more easy, and then you get better results as a consequence. So three kinds of good conduct. Now, the next thing then is, what is the cause for the three kinds of good conduct? And here it has the Indriya Sangvara is the answer given here. Indriya Sangvara, meaning the Sangvara usually translated as restraint, and Indriya are the senses, the five senses or the six senses if you like. And so it is the restraint of the senses that is the fuel or the cause for the for purifying your conduct. Why is that? And the reason is because you can purify your body and speech reasonably well. Yeah, I don't know how you feel about that. Sometimes the speech can be a bit difficult when there are, lots of things are happening and you speak too fast or whatever. Happens very easily. But the hardest part to purify is the mind. And if your mind is pure, your speech and your bodily actions will also be pure as a consequence. So this is why once you have that sense restraint, once you have purified your mind, then all the three kinds of conduct are purified as a consequence of that. And this is why this is the cause for the purification of the three, of all three doors, if you like. They call the three doors, mind, speech, and body. Dvarata yena katang, the three doors, whatever actions you do, and you ask for forgiveness in Pali. So this is why sense restraint is matter. So what actually is sense restraint? This is one of those very interesting things because it's far from obvious. And if you think about the idea of restraint, the word restraint in English, very often it means force. So you might think it's about using force because you're going to restrain yourself. You're going to hold back. You take out a restraining order against somebody. If you have someone who is kind of following you around, you kind of get a bit worried. So you get the police, take out a restraining order against this person who is kind of giving you a hard time or whatever. So restraint always implies a degree of force in the English language. But in the suttas, the way the Buddha usually recommends restraining the mind is actually by using wisdom. It's by reflecting in the right way. If you reflect in the right way, if you think about the situation with yoniso manasikara, we'll come to that fact, it's actually coming up in a second. If you think about things with yoniso manasikara, with wise attention, reflecting wisely, then you actually will restrain the mind in that way. So it doesn't mean any much force, really. The main thing it means is means the idea of pointing the mind in the right direction, thinking about things in the right way, reflecting wisely rather than reflecting stupidly. Please don't reflect stupidly, because it's a bad idea. Reflect wisely instead. And there's a beautiful sutta which I usually like to read out on whenever I teach retreats. It's a sutta found in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, number 2. And in this sutta, it's number, if you want to look it up, it's number 12 and 13, and 11, 12 and 13. In the sutta, the Buddha says there's two powers. And these two the word power is already very significant, because if something is a power, it is something that has an effect in your practice, something that you can use to guide the mind in the right direction. It is powerful. It has an effect in how your life is actually lived. The Buddha says there's two powers, and one power is called the Patisankhana Bala. You know that word, Patisankhana Bala? No? Okay. So just testing your power skills. Bala, okay. So Patisankhana means reflection. Yeah, so it's the power of reflection is what the Buddha is talking about there. And the other one, which you may recognize better, is the Bhavana Bala. And Bhavana, you to translate it as meditation. Yeah, so it's the power of meditation. So these are the two powers. Now, what is the power of meditation? The power of meditation is the seven factors of awakening here. We have just seen it now. In other words, it is that which happens at the very end of the path, that which happens when you're watching the breath, that which happens when you go into samadhi, that is the Bhavana Bala. The Patisankhana Bala is what helps you purify your conduct and your mind, to overcome the bad conduct and to guide your mind to the good conduct, to overcome bad speech to go towards good speech, to abandon bad bodily conduct and go to good bodily conduct, you use the Patisankhana Bala, the power of reflection. Many people think that if you practice meditation in the right way, meditation will overcome the unwholesome qualities of the mind. And it is true if the unwholesome qualities are very small, very tiny. There's a little bit of distraction going on. You are kind of drawn away slightly. And then you bring the mind back to the breath or whatever. Then it is possible to overcome those tiny defilements. But the main defilements in our practice, the kind of ordinary irritations of life, or the anger you might have sometimes, or the kind of big greeds and big desires, and of course the speech and the conduct, all of these kind of things, they are overcome by reflecting in the right way. It's fascinating, isn't it? Because it means that reflection in Buddhism, thinking about things in the right way, is absolutely fundamental for the practice to work out. And this is the idea of sense restraint. It is not to grab hold of the mind, force it to go in one direction or the other one. Don't be angry and kind of hold on, push away the anger. This is how people often, you get upset with yourself for getting angry, so you push it out of your mind. And very often that leads to further problems down the line. Very often it just makes you exhausted. Very often the anger comes back with a vengeance later on. So instead of doing that, far more powerful to reflect in such a way that the anger is actually abolished completely at the root. And by reflecting in the right way, you can actually do that, which is very... It's not that hard, actually. This is the interesting thing. You may sound like to some of you perhaps, like a miracle to get rid of anger like that, but it actually is possible. Something everyone can do if you reflect in the right way. What is that reflection? How do you reflect like that? Well, you just have to remember that people, usually the reason we get upset by other people because they do something silly or they do something bad is because we take it personally. But it's never personal. It's just the other person playing out their own habits, their own programs, their own way of being. And once you remember that people are trapped by these habits and programs, it's very hard to get upset by them in quite the same way. It's very simple. But I'm not going to go too much into that, because otherwise we're going to be here for a long time. Ajahn Brahm told me 1 hour. Okay, 1 hour. Yes, sir, 1 hour. So we'll stay for 1 hour. Sometimes you have to follow your boss, otherwise you get into trouble. So this is the idea of sensory strength. A very important point to remember, that the main aspect of sensory strength is this idea of reflecting in the right way. If you use too much force, you're going to get exhausted. The things will come back again because you haven't really overcome them properly. But if you use reflection, you can actually deal with it at the root and then overcome the problem straight away. Far more powerful, far more efficient, far more pleasant as well at the same time. And more fun. It's more fun to kind of think about the world. How can I think about the world in the right way? Yeah, how can I have more compassion for people? It's more kind of interesting. You're investigating a little bit. So if you have that inquisitive mind, I don't know if you have an inquisitive mind, but if you do, it's much more interesting to think about things and to reflect about them than just to kind of suppress things out of aversion or whatever it is. So that is the idea, just very briefly, about sensory strength. And that is actually a very important topic, and we could have gone on for that for hours, because it deserves hours. But for today, we'll just make it very quick, very brief. Then we have the fuel for the sensory strength. And this here is called mindfulness and clear awareness, perhaps. Situational awareness is Ajahn Sujato's, Sujato's translation. This is Sampajanya. And clear awareness is quite nice, or full awareness or something like that. Situational awareness is okay. It just means that you understand the particular situation you're in and you act in accordance with that situation. That's really what it means, situational awareness, something like that. So the idea here is just that you, very simply, that you understand the purpose of what you're doing. You understand the suitability for reaching that purpose. And then you have that kind of gives rise, makes it possible to have sense restraint as a consequence. So next one. So the cause for that is the yoniso manasikara. This is the proper attention or wise attention, there's a variety of translations that are possible. And this is then attending to things in the right way. And the way to attend to things is basically attending in such a in a way that you don't get angry, you don't get too greedy about things in life. That is the right attention. You don't get confused. You don't get all of these negative consequences. So that is the wise or the proper attention. Attention just means that you are, right now you're attending. Yeah, you're looking at this screen. And perhaps you're hearing what I say, or perhaps you're fantasizing about something. I don't know what you're doing. Everything happens, people do all kinds of things, which is okay. But whatever is the quality of that attention, even if you are thinking about something, even if you're not listening to what I'm saying, it doesn't mean it's wrong attention. Just not listening to me is not bad attention. It just means but it's how you are attending to what you are doing which matters. So if you are thinking about something and you don't really care about what I'm talking about, then make sure you think about that thing in a good way. With metta, with kindness, with whatever. And if you're listening to me, then listen with ill will or anything like that, but with a kind of open and positive mind. That is the quality of the attention. That is why it is called proper attention, because the quality is right in that attention. And that is the kind of one of the root aspects of the entire Buddhist path. If you have the yoniso manasikara, is what is required for anything to really work out. Anything, anytime you are improving and you are kind of, your mind is getting more clear and bright and more positive and more wholesome or whatever, then the reason for that is always yoniso manasikara. That's the cause behind that. Then we have the cause for that again, for yoniso manasikara, is faith. You have it down there. This is sadha in Pali. And sadha is a very important part of that, is the confidence in the Buddha's teachings. So sadha you can also translate as confidence. Faith is only one possibility. But it straddles the two a little bit, because it is confidence in the sense that you get really inspired by these teachings and you think they are great, but it's also that positive feeling that comes with it as well. When you are inspired, you feel well, you feel happy, and you're keen on getting on with the practice and all of these things. So it's both the inspiration from an understanding point of view, and also the inspiration from an emotional point of view. So in that sense, it is a bit like faith. When the Christians talk about faith, usually it's about the emotional aspect of things. But in Buddhism, it's also about it actually straddles the intellectual and the emotional, if you like. So now we're coming very close to the beginning of this whole sequence. And if you look back on this sequence, if you think back about the things that we have been looking at so far, we started off with the seven bhujangas, which is equivalent to samadhi on the Noble Eightfold Path. Then we had the mindfulness meditation, which is equivalent to sammasati, right mindfulness, the seventh factor. Then we have the sense restraint and the sampajanya. We had the three kinds of good conduct. And the three kinds of good conduct really encompasses four of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. It encompasses right effort, it encompasses right livelihood, right action, and right speech. All of those are encompassed by that. And then we have sense restraint, which also is part and parcel of the same thing. And then we had sampajanya and yonisomanasikara. And this is really equivalent to the right intention part of the Buddhist path. You're intending in the right way. So this is the intention aspect. And now, what we're coming to now is the very first part of the Noble Eightfold Path. Saddha is very closely related to wisdom in Buddhism. And of course, right view is also very closely related to wisdom. So what we're coming to now is the right view aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. Faith and right view in Buddhism are almost like two opposite sides, again, or two maybe the same sides even. They're very closely related to each other. There's a nice sutta in the Indriya Samyutta. If you'd like to read the suttas, the Indriya Samyutta is a collection of discourses on the five spiritual faculties. And in those discourses there's one discourse which starts off with faith. And it goes from faith, you have the energy, from energy you have the sati, the mindfulness, from the mindfulness you have the stillness, from the stillness you have the wisdom, and from the wisdom you have the faith. And it goes like in a loop. It goes back to the beginning again. And the reason is because when you have the wisdom, when you see things according to reality, then of course that confirms the faith you had initially. It shows you that your confidence was well placed. And now instead of having a confidence which is based on just hearsay and what the Buddha is saying, it is confirmed by your own experience. That is what wisdom is all about. It's all about your own experience. So in Buddhism, faith and or confidence of faith and wisdom always grow together. They are, again, two sides of the same coin. They're not different. Faith isn't just some kind of preliminary thing. Faith comes together with wisdom. And this is one of those fairly unique things to Buddhism, that these two actually always go together. In other religions, they might talk about faith as something which kind of you have faith regardless. But in Buddhism, it isn't like that. In Buddhism, it is supported by understanding and insight. It is supposed to be a rational and intelligent faith, not some kind of blind faith, which you have regardless of your information and the input that you have. So now we're coming towards the very beginning of the sequence, of these 10 factors. And we are now similar to the aspect of right view. So what is the cause of, what is the fuel for this faith? This is the next one here. And it says here, listening to the true teachings. So Dhamma Savanang here. And of course, the true teachings in Buddhism are the teachings of the Buddha. It doesn't have to be the Buddha. It can be anyone who is awakened, who has similar kind of insight. It could be a Pacheka Buddha. It could be maybe just a random guy in the street. You meet a random, I had this insight. Wow, let me tell you. And then they might actually have some, you never know. It's possible in Buddhism because it's not Buddhism as such which is right. It is the particular insight into reality which matters, which is kind of a beautiful, beautiful thing about the Buddhist teachings. So hearing the true Dhamma, when you hear the Dhamma, if you have the right faculties, if you are ready, you think, whoa, this is so good. This is so beautiful. But you have to be ready. If you are the kind of person who is not ready, you think, what is this nonsense? And you kind of carry on, you walk away. You don't really think about it. There's a beautiful, almost like a simile for that. This is from the, what's the sutta called now? This, I think it's in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. The Arya Pariyasana Sutta is the sutta on the noble searcher. Arya means noble, Pariyasana means searcher. And this is what the Buddha talks about his own life before his awakening, or actually before his awakening, also after his awakening. Yeah. And just after his awakening, yeah, you can imagine becoming a Buddha is pretty amazing. Yeah, bang, wow, it's something really astonishing. You can imagine what it does to you, how it transforms you, if you have this very profound experience of reality here. When you come out on the other side, you're going to be a very different person. And when you started out, you're going to be really clear, very powerful, and people are going to be able to tell that something has happened to you, because you're absolutely peaceful. You have this kind of this aura about you, which is kind of amazing. Yeah, even if someone comes out of a very deep meditation, you will see something different. But if someone is fully enlightened, you're going to feel, whoa, there's something very, very astonishing going on if that happens. So the Buddha, after his awakening, is going to be something very special. So after his awakening, he stays for a while and he meditates for a while. And then he decides to go out and teach the world. And after he's decided to go and teach, he decides to go to Benares, where his five previous disciples are. You know the story of the Buddha's life, yeah? So he starts walking out to Benares. And on his way to Benares, he meets this Ajivaka called Upaka, yeah? Upaka the Ajivaka. Ajivaka was another sect in India at the time. They were also a spiritual sect. So he meets this Ajivaka, and this Ajivaka says, "Whoa, what happened to you, man?" Well, not quite like that, but you know, something like that. Because he realized there's something about this person that is absolutely out of the ordinary. He's like radiant. There's something really, really special about this person. And then the Buddha says, this is amazing. Who is your teacher? And then the Buddha says, well, actually, I haven't got a teacher. I'm a fully self-awakened Buddha. And because I'm self-awakened, I have no teacher. But of course, saying that you didn't have a teacher, that was kind of unheard of in the world. Nobody said that. Everybody had a teacher somewhere. So this Upaka said, well, that means that you are some kind of, world-conquering spiritual saint or something. The Buddha said, yes. Something to that effect. And then Upaka said, yeah, whatever. And he kind of walks off, yeah. And this shows you how easy it is to go wrong here. Here you are. You are face to face with the Buddha. You're face to face with the greatest spiritual genius in human history. Yeah. You're face to face with the absolute truth. You should be able to recognize it. It's right there. It's kind of standing out of this person. Yeah, radiating out of him. And still you can't see it. You walk off in the wrong direction. And this is what it is like even now with the vast majority of people. You hear these teachings of the Buddha. You hear this Dhamma. And you don't recognize it. You think, yeah, whatever. And then you go back to your Islam, or you go back to your Christianity, or you go back to being a free thinker, or an atheist, or agnostic, or you believe in Thor and Odin, or whatever it is. You know, all of that. And you don't actually get it, that there's something powerful here. And this is the truth for some people, at least. But a lot of people, I think, when they really reflect on these teachings, and they get it explained in a sensible way, where it actually people can relate to it in a proper way, they actually see that there's something very powerful going on here. So just listening to these teachings, but it has to be the right ones. Yeah, it can't be some kind of pseudo-Buddhism. It has to be the real deal, otherwise it doesn't work. Then faith very often arises as a consequence. And this is the thing here. There's actually a very important point in this whole idea of not being able to recognize the Buddha. One of the things that you will often hear in the Buddhist world now is that Buddhism is kind of deteriorating, it's getting corrupted, it's not the same as it was, 2,500 years, it can't really become enlightened anymore. These are standard things that you hear around the Buddhist world. You don't hear it here, I hope. If you hear it here, then let me know, because we've got to sort it out. you shouldn't, in this kind of BSWR, you shouldn't be hearing these kind of teachings. And the problem with that, and they say, yeah, we'll just hang out, yeah, we'll wait for the next Buddha to come around. But the next time the Buddha come around, you're going to be Upaka. Yeah, you're going to say, yeah, whatever, and you're going to walk off. And you're going to walk off in the wrong direction. How easy is it to recognize a Buddha? The reason why we are Buddhists now is because Buddhism is already a large teaching. It is available in the world, it's easy to access. There are other Buddhists around. But if you are the first person to meet a Buddha after his awakening, will you recognize it? If some man comes down the street and says, I'm awakened, What are you going to do? You're just going to walk off, yeah? You're not going to listen to a person like that. There's no way, because usually they're nuts, the people that say those kind of things. You're not going to listen to them. And this is the problem. So next time there is a Buddha, you have no idea. You probably won't even be able to recognize the Buddha for who he, or maybe she, is when that happens in the future. So for this reason, this is one of the very important reasons that to always remind yourself that now is the opportunity. Yeah, you don't know about the future. Yeah? Anyway, I'm getting a bit sidetracked here. So what is the fuel for hearing the true Dhamma? And the answer is to associating with good people, saparisa, or if you like, superior people. Saparisa means good or superior or something like that. And sangseva means to associate with, to hang out with. Doesn't have to be too kind of formal, just being with the right people. Then you, this whole, there's nothing more further down. That's it. No, go up again, please. Eileen, yeah. There's nothing more, that's it. I don't want to go any further than that. That's enough. So next one is the other sutta. So just stay there for a while. So this is the root cause of the entire path. If you want to reach awakening, this is what you have to do. You have to hang out with the good people, hang out with the superior people. Yeah. So this is what it's all about. So how can you hang out with the superior people? What does that mean? And of course, what it really means is to have access to those teachings and also to have access to the example of those teachings well lived and properly lived, so that you actually then you get that input all the time, which reminds you of the Buddhist path, which reminds you of what it is that we have to do. This is the root cause. That's what you have to do. Yeah, if you do that, then there is almost guaranteed that this path is going to start happening to some extent. But the point is that you have to do it again and again and again. You can't just do it once. You can't just come to Jhana Grove and hang out with Ajahn Brahm for a while and say, that's good enough, now I'm going to go back, and next year I'll come back again. That's not really good enough. You have to do it on a regular basis. You have to do it all the time. Yeah. So how can we do that? Well, one thing you can do is you can read the suttas a little bit. That's what we're trying, kind of sort of doing now. Read the suttas for yourself as well. See if you get inspired. Listen to some nice sutta readings by people who know what they're talking about. Gain some regular advice in your practice. Make sure that you get inspired when you feel a bit down. However you get inspired by listening to a talk or whatever it is. But come back to these teachings. And if you come back to these teachings, if you hang out with the Buddha, this is how you hang out with the Buddha, by reading his teachings. Yeah, he doesn't have to be here. This is how you do it. Then it's going to happen. Gradually, you're going to move up this hierarchy, move through this causal sequence, until eventually you're going to be an arahant. You're going to be fully awakened. It happens almost naturally. It's a natural kind of process, one thing happening after the other one. Why? Because you get inspired. Why? Because you want to do these things. That's why you're here now. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here if you hadn't been inspired by some of this at the beginning. Of course, there's going to be obstacles and things on the way. And that's why you have to keep coming back to these things. You have to keep on reflecting. You have to find the solutions to the problems and all of these kind of things. But if you keep on doing it, you will go past all of these things. And it may sound like a miracle to you. It may sound kind of unachievable. How can you just hang out with the right teachings, with the right people, and the path happening? But the simile that the Buddha uses is very briefly. I'm not going to say much about it. But the simile of the Buddha is that, if imagine that there is a mountain here. On this mountain, it rains on the mountain here. When it rains on the mountain, if you keep on raining on that mountain, eventually the water will form into little streams. And as the rain keeps coming, those streams will start to swell and become larger. And those streams will merge into larger streams. Eventually those larger streams, if the rain keeps coming, the larger streams will go into the little lakes. And the little lakes, if it keeps on raining, but it has to keep on raining. It's the only way it's going to work. It doesn't work if you stop raining. Keep on raining, those little lakes will overflow. They will flow into the large lakes. If it keeps on raining, eventually the large lakes too will overflow. And they will overflow into the large rivers. And eventually, if the rain keeps coming, those large rivers will go all the way to the ocean. This is the Buddha's simile for how this works. So if you keep on, the rain here symbolizes coming back to the good people, the superior people. coming back to the word of the Buddha, hanging out with the noble ones, listening to these teachings. And as you do so, this whole process, the raining, keeps on eventually bringing that river all the way to the ocean. So this is the most important thing here. And the reason why this is so important is because this is the same thing here as the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is all about right view. Yeah, the right ideas, how to look at the world, how to think about the world in the right way. And when you do that, everything happens as a consequence. So very powerful. So if you want to have success in your meditation practice, you have to ensure that you have as much sila, as much virtue, the three kinds of good conduct, avoiding the bad conduct, as much as you possibly can throughout your life, throughout your daily life, in your family, in your work, yeah, in your Buddhist community, whatever that is, all the way, all the time, you have to kind of push that sila and make it as pure as you possibly can. The way to do that, the way to ensure that your sila is pure, is to make sure that you have a view that supports the sila, and that view which supports the sila is the right view. Yeah, this view, if you have it, if you reflect on it, if you use the power of reflection, it will support your conduct at all times. This is the power of right view. So what do we mean by right view? Having looked at all of this, I'm going to talk a little bit about right view just at the very end here. You have to go to the other sutta now, please, Eileen. Yeah. And the idea of right view in the suttas, there's many aspects of right view, and you will probably have heard of those aspects of right view before. People often talk about, we talk about kamma and rebirth, yeah, as very important parts of right view, and they are very important. But very often we stop at that. We think that if we, yeah, I believe in karma, I believe in rebirth, okay, good enough, I got right view, next step on the path. It doesn't work like that. That's not the point. The point is not just to have right view and then you kind of, yes, I believe in something. It becomes a bit like believing in God or something like that. Yeah, it becomes almost like Christianity almost. That's not really the point. The point is to understand the implications of this. What does it mean if there is karma? What does it mean if there is rebirth? And to reflect on that in as deeply as you possibly can. And the more deep your reflection on these things then is, the more you understand what this actually entails in terms of your life, in terms of what life is all about, the more powerful it becomes. And then when you come back, go back home, when you live your ordinary life, actually the virtue and the kindness comes almost automatically as a consequence. So what do we mean? So again, there's many different angles on this, and there's many suttas on right view, the kind of the, you know, the samsaric cycle of running around, going from one life to another life, heaping up bones from, you know, from one life to the next one, bigger than the mountains in ancient India and all of this. But one of the ways of thinking about right view is the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are really also an aspect of right view. In fact, all the suttas, everything the Buddha said is really right view in a certain way. Whenever you read a sutta, it's a way of looking at life, looking at the practice, understanding the Dhamma, which is in accordance with reality. So it's right view. And of course, the Four Noble Truths are in many ways a summary of the entire Buddha's teachings. So this certainly is about right view. So very briefly, so here we are. So here you have the right view. You have rebirth is suffering, old age is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, association with the disliked is suffering, separation from the liked is suffering, not getting what you wish for is suffering. In brief, the five grasping aggregates are suffering here. So this is the, you don't have to go any further, Eileen, that's good. And this here already is very powerful and very important to understand what is going on here. So it starts off with rebirth is suffering, okay. All age is suffering, illness is suffering. We can kind of relate to that to some extent because all of these things have to do with problems very often. But the most powerful at the very beginning there of these things is the idea that death is suffering. It's a very powerful thing. It is something that the Buddha talks about in the suttas again and again. The idea of the marana sati or the marana sanya, contemplation of death or perception of death, whatever you want to call it. It's very important because it actually reminds you of what really matters in life. And it is interesting how hard it can be to do this properly, to actually get really good results. And sometimes it takes special circumstances before it really works out. I have been reminded myself of those special circumstances recently because my own father passed away about 6 months ago, and my sister passed away only a few weeks ago. So it's interesting when you have very close family members who pass away, because then it drives home the point of death. It makes it so much more powerful. So what happens when someone dies who is close to you? And one of the things that happens, if you have the right attitude to it, is that it actually is quite peaceful. It's quite calming. Yeah, why is it calming? And the reason why it is calming is because you are faced with the one obvious reality of death, is that you can't hold on to anything. You can't take anything with you. You have to let go of everything in this world. And that is a nice theory if it is not happening to you. It's a nice theory when you read about someone in the newspaper, someone far away who's passed away, and maybe you can apply the Buddhist teachings in a certain way. But it becomes very real when it is a family member. It becomes even more real if you get sick and you are on the kind of on the way out. But it becomes very real then. When you see it happening to your own family members, it becomes so obvious that there's nothing there to hold on to. And my sister, for example, she was still kind of in the prime of her life. She was just past 50, 52 years old. And she was running a big farm, and she had two children and all of these kind of things. Of course, you see that any kind of future project, the whole idea, this farm that she was running, she was kind of building it up from scratch. It was a very, very nice, very beautiful farm. But lots of work, and she was kind of building it up, and her whole life was about this farm. It was about a vision of building something up, creating something for the future. And that future never came. It never happened. She worked on it for a while. Then she got cancer very badly. She couldn't do very much anymore. And then she passed away. And this is the thing about life, is that we often run after these dreams. We run after something in the future. We have this idea of the future being better than the past, the future having some kind of promise. But the problem is that from a samsaric point of view, the problem of how the Buddha teaches these things is that future never really arrives. There isn't really a point where you actually get all those things right that you want to have. It never comes a point when that farm is actually finished. If she had finished the farm, she would have started another project. Yeah, something else to do. There never is that future which you are looking for, that golden idea of where you want to go. It never actually happens. And because it never happens, it is very problematic. Because in the meantime, because you have the idea of building something up, relationships, family members, children, good reputation, whatever it is, building all of these things up, and in the middle of building all of that up, you die, and then you have to start from scratch again. And so it goes on and on and on, without any real future, without any real solution, without any real goal, no final endpoint to these things. There's nothing in this world we can hold on to. All of this has to be given up. And when that sinks in, that everything has to be given up, everything in this life is like borrowed. You have it for a while, then you have to give it up again. Once you get that, it changes your attitude to this life. If everything you do is build up things that belong to this world, if everything you do is run a farm, if everything you do is build up your relationships in a family, and you don't really think about how you live at all, then because those things are what matter to you, you're going to attach to them. These things are going to be what your life is all about. And then when you die, everything that matters to you, everything that is important in your life, is going to go. You feel like you're kind of naked. Everything has to go. There's nothing left. Nothing you can take with you. So the power of the death contemplation is that you don't start to think about life in a different way. You realize that all the ordinary things in life are not that important, because you can't really take them with you anyway. They're not going to last in the long run. If you make too much out of those things, the only thing you're going to do is attach more, and it's going to make it even more problematic to let go when eventually you're going to have to die. And it was so obvious with my sister. He was someone who has struggled and struggled, worked so hard. Yeah, and then she gets cancer here. And then now she's leaving this world. She was there towards the end. She was completely emaciated from cancer. There was nothing left. And then suddenly, before anyone could, you know, before you knew it, she was dead. It happened very, very fast towards the end. So this is such an important reflection here. So bring that reflection into your life. And what happens when you do that is you start to prioritize in a different way. Instead of prioritizing the worldly things, instead of prioritizing the promotions at work or the salaries that you have, instead of prioritizing getting on with with whatever it is in life, you don't prioritize those things in the same way. Instead, you prioritize the intention you put into those things. It is not necessarily about doing anything different. You don't have to become a monastic. You don't have to become some kind of Singapore hermit, you know, living in your apartment in Singapore in a hermit kind of fashion. You don't have to do that. But what you do is you change your attitude to the things around you. You change your attitude to your colleagues at work. You don't see them as competitors anymore. You don't see them. You see them as fellow sufferers in samsara. You see them as an opportunity to be kind and to be helpful towards these people. And when you do that, you're opening the doors to a spiritual life, even at work, even in your family, even in the midst of all the worldly things. That is how you change. Why? Because these are the things that you will be able to take with you when you die. When you die, you know you have lived well, you know you have been kind to the people around you, you know you have been supportive of the world as it is. When you know that, you feel good about yourself. You feel you haven't wasted your life. You don't have all these things in the world that are attached to so much. Instead, you take with you that glow in your heart, that light heart that you have built up over a long period of time. You feel, yay, I lived my life well. Wow, what a wonderful thing. And you die with a smile on your face. And if you die with a smile on your face, where are you going to go? Good destination, right? Yeah, you don't need to convert to Christianity on your deathbed. It's good, isn't it? Yeah, no need to correct that. You are, because you know inside of you, if you have a bright mind, a person with a bright mind always goes to a good destination. It feels that way. You know that is true. And if you convert to Christianity, it doesn't matter if you convert, you're still going to go to a bad destination because your mind isn't bright. Yeah, that's irrelevant. Anyway, you can't convert like that anyway. Nobody can convert on the deathbed. This is complete silliness. So this is how it works. You just change your attitude. You change your outlook. You change your priorities. You change your values. And as you do that, your whole life takes on a new direction. And you start to think about the world in a different way. So death contemplation is extremely powerful. But you have to, instead of waiting for someone to die, instead of waiting for yourself to be on the deathbed or whatever, you have to do it now. Make it real now. And if you make it real now, it will have an impact on how you think about your life. So this is the first thing, very briefly towards the end. We're coming towards the end, very end now already. One of the other things is one of the interesting things about the world sometimes, when you look at the world, sometimes you can despair a little bit about the state of the world and about all the strange leaders that we have in this world. And I shall mention no names, of course. Or you look at things that are happening around, like things in Hong Kong, yeah, where people are really up in arms and there are all these protests in the streets and all demonstrations or whatever. And I know quite a few people in Hong Kong. I'm actually going there in a couple of weeks' time to lead a retreat. And people are kind of writing and saying, oh, maybe you shouldn't come. There's too much stuff happening in Hong Kong. But of course, when things are happening, that's a good time to go, because that's when it's interesting. That's when there is a need for Dhamma. That's when you can actually understand the Dhamma, when these things are happening. So when you look at the world like that and you feel, you wonder where the world is going, where are we going to kind of have a climate breakdown? Are we going to kind of, what's going to happen with the world basically? And you worry about these things, then remember that this is what the Buddha was talking about. When the Buddha is talking about anicca, when the Buddha is talking about impermanence, this is what he means. So if you are in Hong Kong, I understand there is someone from Hong Kong here, is that right? Yeah? So you're from Hong Kong. Okay, very good. So, if you are from Hong Kong, and you are from Hong Kong, so that's good. If you are, then there's different ways of thinking about the situation in Hong Kong. Either you can get depressed and sad, and some people, of course, do get depressed and sad when they hear about what's happening. That doesn't really help. It doesn't get you anywhere. Or you can take to the streets and you can demonstrate and you can kind of do what you think is right. Yeah, we've got to sort this thing out or whatever. That's another way. Try to do the right thing. But you don't know. Even if you go demonstrating in the streets, you don't know if it's going to go your way. Probably not, because, you know, if the Chinese government is behind this, it's then much stronger than you are. So probably in the end, you're going to have to give up anyway. There is another way of looking at this, which is far more powerful, which is very, very useful in terms of right view and thinking about the Dhamma in the right way. That is to think, well, this is precisely the nature of the world. It has to be this way. It will always change. Nothing is ever stable. Yes, maybe we had a beautiful way of living in Hong Kong till now, but that beautiful way of living never lasts. Yeah, actually, it's not. I mean, Hong Kong is already pretty crowded, and it's not that beautiful. It's okay, but but you know, it's good. Yeah, it's still good. Hong Kong has a very prosperous society, and many, many good things happening there. And I love going to Hong Kong. There's a nice retreat center and things over there. Yeah. But remember, this is what it's like. Yeah. This is nature. This is what the Buddha is talking about. Nothing has gone wrong if Donald Trump becomes president. Yeah, it's nature to have Donald Trump as president sometimes. It's bad, maybe bad news, but it's still nature. Yeah, this is what happens. It's nature to have all this kind of violence around the world. You see wars around the world everywhere. Actually, it's always been like that. There's always been wars among humanity. It's a miracle that sometimes you live in a society where there's not war. Yeah, think about Singapore. You have this tiny little island, and there's all these big countries on both sides. Yeah, and sometimes you are kind of, you know, the differences are often quite remarkable, big between Singapore and those countries on the outside. It's astonishing you have been living at peace. You should kind of, you know, you should be very happy you've been at peace for so many years. Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? And this is kind of the scary thing. So when you look at things in the right way, when you understand this is what the Buddha is talking about, what actually happens is that you, instead of trying to, you can still fight for what is right. It's still okay, good to fight, but fight with a good heart. Don't get angry about things. If you want to do the right thing, always do it with a good heart. But in the end, you don't know the outcome. In the end, what is going to happen is very uncertain. And because it is uncertain, because it is unreliable, you understand this is the nature of the world. It takes away the interest in the world. It takes away the idea that there is a solution. There is no solution. This is the point. There may be a temporary solution. There may be temporarily going in the right way. But in the long run, there is no solution. This is kind of a radical way of thinking about things, because we always think there is a solution. Yeah, we always think that there is a way of organizing things. But in the long run, there is no solution. In the long run, it just goes around. It comes back to the beginning again. And maybe, you know, 100 years time, maybe we're back in the Stone Age again. That might be nice. Yeah, we could come back here. We'd be in the Stone Age and we can kind of do a meditation retreat. That would be interesting. But it's just so unreliable. And if you look at the Buddhist idea of the universe, of the world, it is precisely like that. It's a cyclical thing. You go around, you come back roughly to where you started out. And this is the problem with existence. And when you do that, you start looking for those, you don't become so interested in the world anymore. You withdraw some of your desire to kind of make things work out in the world, because you know that in the long run, it will never work out. And then you are encouraged to practice the spiritual life instead. Instead of asking, what are the results I should get? Instead, you ask, how can I live in the right way? Live with kindness, live with care, live with a lack of anger and greed, and live instead in a wholesome way in the world. And that is what happens if you have the right attitude to these kind of things. So never despair, and never, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do or you should do, or there's nothing that one should do, one shouldn't do. The only thing you should do is to make sure that you always have a good heart, that you practice in the right way, that you use these things as an inspiration for insight, for right view, for looking at the world in the right way. And if you do that, what you do when you go back home and you think about these things in the right way, it is going to help you in your practice, because your view, your attitude is right. Your values are going to fall into place. And when your values fall into place, everything else tends to happen as a consequence in the right way. Okay, enough for now. So have a nice cup of tea or whatever you do, whatever you. And then I'll be back again at 8 o'clock and we can do some Q&A at 8 o'clock.
Very good.